Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican crusade to appoint a Supreme Court justice committed to the anti-abortion movement. Jessica Mason-Pieklo, the Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news and the 2018 recipient of the Excellence in Online Journalism Award, joins us to discuss the list of potential Supreme Court appointees and the likely choice of a woman to overturn Roe v. Wade, former Notre Dame University law professor Amy Barrett, a right-wing Catholic ideologue who believes in fetal personhood. We will assess Amy Barrett's lack of experience in the courtroom and conservative excuses for her underwhelming credentials, and Jessica's view that the true battle in the fight for abortion rights will be played out in the states. And while Roe v. Wade may withstand direct attack, many states will outlaw women's reproductive rights, creating a Handmaid's Tale scenario in red states in the future as Christian vigilantes check the papers of young women at Greyhound bus stations fleeing to blue states for abortions. Then we'll turn to the religious groundings of judges in the federal courts and speak with Sophia Resnick, an investigative reporter for Rewire News, who has exposed religious influence on academic research and public policy in the areas of reproductive health. She joins us to discuss the Blackstone Legal Fellowships, a 9-week program of indoctrination of young Christian, mostly white, law professionals in the fundamentalist ideals of the Christian right. This is a movement which believes that religious ideals supersede social structures as they drive for the restoration of the religious practices of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century. Then finally, we will look into the origins of the ongoing movement to stack our courts with conservative judges who strictly adhere to what they claim is the original intent of the U.S. Constitution. Carl Tobias, Chair and Professor of Law at the University of Richmond, who specializes in federal judicial selection, joins us to discuss the history of the Federalist Society, a network of debating societies which has established strong circles of conservative influence at law schools. The Federalists have already supplied the Supreme Court with Justices Robert, Alito, and Gorsuch, and the Trump White House has outsourced the selection of Kennedy's replacement to them while they stack the rest of the federal bench with their members. And joining us now is Jessica Mason-Pieklo, Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. She is a writer and law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is a former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota. The recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award, she co-authored Crow After Roe, How Women's Health is the New Separate but Equal and How to Change That. And she has an article at Rewire.news, Why I Believe President Donald Trump Will Choose a Woman to Kill Roe v. Wade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Mason-Pieklo.
So, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And just get right to it. Why do you think that President Donald Trump will choose a woman to kill Roe v. Wade?
Well, conservatives have been gunning for this moment since the ink was dry on the Roe opinion, quite frankly. And Kennedy was the last vote from the right, we can say, to uphold abortion rights. And this is their moment, and they're going to seize it. And nominating a woman to be the final vote cast in that serves a couple different ends for them. One, it obviously gets the goal of ending Roe, but also it gives them a optical victory. It allows them to pressure the Republican senators, Murkowski from Alaska and Susan Collins from Maine, who have suggested they're waffling a little bit. But it also allows them to crow feminism, quite frankly.
Well, there's also, even if the two Republican women senators, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, do stick to their guns and vote down a nominee who, Susan Collins doesn't phrase it in terms of Roe v. Wade, but in established precedent. Mm-hmm. And of course, that gives them all these Federalists some wiggle room. But on the other side, you've got, three Democrats who voted for mm-hmm. Gorsuch. So That's also, isn't that not where there's also an equal, if not greater problem?
Yeah, no, you are absolutely right there. I mean, the calculus depends on the Senate Democrats voting in unison. And as you so correctly pointed out, they haven't done that yet. And we have a couple who they are very clearly targeting to peel off. Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, for example. And, you know, even the Republican senators themselves voted for Gorsuch, too. And so by Susan Collins' own stated standards, he violates that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of work to do to put the pressure on these folks.
Well, but isn't it just a simple fact? I mean, let's not beat about the bush. Anybody on the Federalist list is against Roe v. Wade, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, to be against this stated precedent is a prerequisite to making the list. And it's really astonishing in some ways to see how dishonest they're being about this right now, because, you know, conservative legal scholars literally since the opinion came down have said that they believe it's wrongly decided, that it's not well reasoned, that there are all these problems with it. And now that they have an opportunity to appoint somebody who aligns with those views, but the public wouldn't support, they're trying to suggest that somehow it's not a big deal, and it would be shocking to them if anybody chosen actually did that.
Well, let's go through the list of women that are on the Federalist list. Now, he's reduced it down, at least it seems that way, to four people, one of whom is a woman, and that is Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who's just been made a judge only. What, about a year ago, she was a professor at Notre Dame and apparently an ardent opponent of abortion. She's been interviewed along with Kavanaugh and the other two. I don't have their names in front of me. But the other people on the list of women are Judge Allison Eade, Joan Larson, Judge Diane Sykes, and Margaret Ryan of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. So let's start with any of them. Do you think any of them have a prayer? Because it seems, according to the press reports, that on Monday it's going to be one of the four that have already been interviewed. And my hunch is that it's very much likely to be. This is why I wanted to talk to you, because I agree with you. I think these cynical SOBs are going to put a woman on the court to kill Roe v. Wade, and that'll be Judge Amy Coney Barrett. So walk us through the credentials for the other women.
Okay. So, yeah, I agree with you that I think it's going to be Amy Coney Barrett for a couple reasons, in particular, not just because of all the credentials, also because she's Mike Pence's favorite, and he largely runs the judicial nomination process in the behind the scenes for the Trump administration. But let's talk about some of the others. Joan Larson, frankly, would be a smart choice by the cynics in the administration if they were going for this strategy, because she would be more difficult to oppose because her record, while extremely anti-choice and extremely conservative, doesn't come across as the same religious conservatism that Amy Coney Barrett has displayed. So while a professor at the University of Notre Dame, Barrett was instrumental in helping sort of organize opposition to the Affordable Care Act's birth control benefit and the university's pushback against that. And as an institution, conservatives really rallied around them in the courts. And she's written extensively about her beliefs in terms of natural law and the idea that the law should protect the rights of people from the moment that they exist. And this is a line of reasoning in Roe where the court refused to recognize fetal personhood and that life begins at conception, because to do so would criminalize abortion outright and also miscarriages and contraception and a whole host of things. Really that extreme. Joan Larson would vote the same way as Amy Coney Barrett, but she's not as extreme in her ideology. She comes from Michigan. She's currently on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Her nomination would put Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow in a pinch, as there would be pressure to vote against her nomination as a woman, though knowing she would be an anti-choice vote. She's also had some experience working on issues of executive power, and so that may be appealing to the administration. That may make her more of a target in Senate hearings, to the extent that, you know, those things work. So there's one possibility. You also mentioned Diane Sykes. She's from Wisconsin. She's formerly on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and her background comes from more or less the policies of the Scott Walker administration. So she has a good credentials on economic conservatism and a history of reliably anti-choice votes. However, while she was a judge on recently appointed on the Seventh Circuit, she voted to strike an Indiana law that would have defunded Planned Parenthood. So I think that probably puts her lower down on the list.
And again, I'm speaking with Jessica Mason-Pierclo, who is a vice president of law and the courts at Rewire.news. She is a writer and law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is the former assistant director of the health law clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, the recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award. She co-authored Crow After Row, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal and How to Change That. And she has an article at Rewire.news, Why I Believe President Donald Trump will choose a woman to kill Roe v. Wade. So let's turn to the woman most likely to be the next Supreme Court appointee, and that is Judge Amy Coney Barrett. I just mentioned she's only been on the bench a very short period of time. She was appointed by Donald Trump, having never, ever been a judge. And I don't know how much time she's actually spent in a courtroom, because she's been a law professor, has she not, at Notre Dame University, where she led a group of academics who were hostile to abortion.
That's correct. Yeah, she has some experience in private practice, but really sort of launched her career in academics and comes to the court from academics. And, you know, conservatives have pushed back against the idea that she's never been a judge before as something that should not disqualify her, by pointing to Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. Justice Kagan didn't serve as a judge before her nomination to the Supreme Court either. But unlike Barrett, she's had extensive litigation experience in the Solicitor General's office, so she knew her way around a courtroom.
So touch, if you will, on her activities at Notre Dame in terms of this group of, I can't remember what the name of the group was, that were opposed to abortion that she belonged to.
So Notre Dame is a Catholic university, but it does have a diversity of ideology within its faculty. And so, but within that, Amy Coney Barrett falls on the far right of that spectrum. And as you mentioned, she was part of a faculty group that promoted a series of ideas that fall in line with Catholic legal thinking. And they revolve around the idea of what we talk about in legal circles as natural law. And natural law effectively says that people get their rights first from God, and that if there is a conflict between those, that it is an obligation to hold up the natural rights versus the legal rights or your civic rights. So Amy Coney Barrett has a history of legal writings about her belief that you put faith before civic judgment in that sense. And that has very much informed her academic work. So she has, while a faculty member, not just written against abortion. I mean, being against abortion is a pretty standard Catholic position, but she has written extensively about the legal underpinnings of Roe and the ways in which she thinks it's wrong. And that doesn't just extend to abortion. It extends to all sorts of areas of reproductive and sexual privacy, including contraception, and also including death with dignity laws, so that when we take this line of thinking that Amy Coney Barrett has demonstrated, what it is absolutely a belief that it is the court's job to rule in line with certain very conservative Christian legal precedents.
Well, but this is the weird part, though, Jessica. At these Supreme Court nomination hearings, they never answer any questions, really.
Yeah.
And they just give these boilerplate answers, mm-hmm. and all these generalizations. Nobody's going to be able to get any of these candidates, mm-hmm. whether it's Amy Barrett or the others, Kavanaugh and company, none of them would answer the question, are you going to overturn Roe v. Wade? They simply won't answer it. So that part of it's going to be a total waste of time, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like we just need to flip the script on how these hearings go, since you're right. We know they won't answer those questions. It's a worthless question to ask. Anybody who would be on the court as a Trump nominee would absolutely be that fifth vote. And even Susan Collins' statement of her belief that Gorsuch and Roberts would vote to uphold precedent is I've seen folks call it naive, and it's not naive. She's being intentionally misleading here. She knows that this term Gorsuch and Robert voted time and time again to depart away from precedent. I mean, we have the Janus case where we gutted public sector employee unions. That was them specifically voting against 40 years of decided law and just being fine. I'm doing it. Justice Gorsuch has built an entire legal career on the idea that we need to undo the administrative state in the courts, and to do that is voting against precedent. So Susan Collins is not being honest there. I think, frankly, what needs to happen is that we have a moment of time between the nomination is announced and hearings start, and we need to make sure that we let folks know that the nominee is not acceptable. Quite frankly, none of the people who are on Trump's shortlist are acceptable. If you have any sort of belief that the courts should operate as a centrist check on the executive and the legislative branch.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Jessica Mason-Pieklo, let's talk about how this is going to shake out if they overturn Roe v. Wade. What they'll do, of course, is uphold these various state laws. I think 22 states have brought about these anti-abortion laws, which gut Roe v. Wade. And that's my understanding, that it's likely to happen, that a bunch of red states in this country will be the first to outlaw abortion.
As it stands right now, we have four states with what we call trigger laws on the books, and those are laws that are set to take effect immediately if Roe v. Wade is overturned, that would recriminalize abortion. And then we have about a dozen states or so that have what I call zombie laws that get reanimated. They are what are currently unenforceable abortion bans that prosecutors could then start enforcing. So about roughly 20 states would have abortion access immediately under risk. And that is just simply if they were to overturn it. You know, there are a lot of different ways that this could play out. The court could effectively decide to not take quite as radical step and say, we won't say Roe v. Wade is no longer good law, but what we'll do is mess with the standard under Casey and then effectively allow all anti-abortion restrictions to stand, to make the standard so low that any of them pass. So you get to overturn Roe v. Wade without maybe the political upcry that you'd have. Then, frankly, the worst case scenario is a decision that simultaneously overturns right to a legal abortion in Roe and affirms a right to life under the 14th Amendment, which Roe expressly rejected. And if that is the case, then the court has created constitutional personhood for a developing pregnancy.
But won't this mean, I mean, it's beginning to, the dark clouds on the horizon are beginning to resemble The Handmaid's Tale, the idea that in this country, in these red states, you will have, within a couple of years probably, you will have Christian vigilantes at Greyhound bus stations checking the papers of young women who would save what little money they have and are going to take a Greyhound bus to a blue state where they can get an abortion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I really try to drive home to folks in this conversation is that when we are talking about this, what we are talking about is state power, is the state's power over your ability to have a child, to not have a child, and the conditions under which you have a child. And that is a lot of power and authority to grant the state.
So it's not too far-fetched to suggest that we'll have these kind of, you know, religious fascist type, you know, Handmaid's Tale type situations in this very country.
I think we're seeing that play out, quite frankly, with the way the administration is handling its family separation policy. We have these children going and being placed in facilities in Michigan with Bethany Social Services, for example, which is a Christian international and domestic adoption and child placement service agency, heavily funded by the DeVos family, for example, and was subsidized by the Pence administration when he was governor of Indiana. So to the extent that they're beta testing some of these policies, I think that that's happening.
Well, it is extraordinary, isn't it? And just in closing, can you give us some hope that something can be done to stop this? I know the Democrats don't have the votes, but again, we have the tyranny of the minority in this country. This is a minority government.
It is. It is absolutely that. We don't at the moment have the votes, but a lot can change with the right amount of information and upcry. We've seen that. I mean, we saw it with the attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. And a lot of credit goes to the disability rights community there for putting their literal bodies on the line to stop that vote and to make sure that didn't happen. So we have models for success for dealing with this minority. I'm not naive to think that it will be easy, but I have not given up hope yet.
Well, Jessica Mason Piekulo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jessica Mason Piekulo, who's a vice president of law and the courts at Rewire.news. She is a writer and law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is the former assistant director of the health law clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, the recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award. She co-authored Crow After Roe, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal and How to Change That. And she has an article at Rewire.news, Why I Believe President Donald Trump Will Choose a Woman to Kill Roe v. Wade. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a fundamentalist Christian movement infiltrating our judiciary.
It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
When I don't care if it rains or freezes,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sophia Resnick, who is an investigative reporter for Rewire.news, who has uncovered abuse and exposed religious influence on academic research and public policy in the area of reproductive health and LGBT discrimination. She was previously an investigative reporter for the American Independent and has written for the Austin Chronicle, and she co-authored the investigative piece at Rewire.news, Not the Illuminati, How Fundamentalist Christians Are Infiltrating State and Federal Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sophia Resnick.
Thank you very much for having me.
And before we get into this hitherto, you know, this rather unknown, perhaps even stealth group, the Blackstone Fellowship, let's talk about the current selections for the Supreme Court, the shortlist, which will be announced on Monday. It's hard not to notice that there is a kind of confluence between the Federalist Society, who have picked these judges and mm-hmm. who basically have been, you know, Trump's outsourced all of his judicial picks to the Federalist Society. Leonard Leah, who runs it, I believe, is a very religious Catholic. So there is a confluence, is there not, between either religious fundamentalism or certain conservative religions and the Federalist Society?
Yes. And there is also, you know, I believe, a relationship between the Federalist Society and the Alliance Defending Freedom, which I know we're going to talk about shortly. But many of the lawyers who belong to both, there's definitely an overlap. And there's also a, as you mentioned, you know, what they share, a lot of them share, is a Christian worldview.
So let's then talk about the Alliance Defending Freedom. Who's backing it? They were involved in the Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission case before the Supreme Court recently.
Yes, they were indeed. And they were also involved in the other high-profile Supreme Court case recently, NIFLA versus Basura, regarding crisis pregnancy centers in California. The Alliance Defending Freedom, they are, it's an Arizona religious legal organization, and they were founded in 1994, I believe. And they they're relatively, I think they're growing name recognition over the years, but they've been, you know, a growing legal force over the decades, and sort of quietly helping to construct many of these Christian influenced laws. They, for example, they were, in addition to the fact that they helped defend the plaintiffs in the Hobby, in the famous Hobby Lobby case involving whether it was, you know, unconstitutional for to require insurance companies to provide contraceptive coverage to Americans, and they argued successfully that it was religious discrimination, essentially. So in addition to helping to defend the plaintiffs in the Hobby Lobby case and in the similar contraceptive cases, they essentially helped construct the argument behind, they helped construct their argument behind these defenses. And as Rewire has written about in the past, the Alliance Defending Freedom helped coordinate all of these different state attorneys general and got them all on the same page in how they were going to argue that case. So they've been very influential over the years, especially in the areas of trying to restrict reproductive rights, trying to restrict LGBT equality, trying to eviscerate, essentially, the separation of church and state in this country.
So let's talk about this group that I take it they have formed, right, the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Blackstone Fellowship. It's an annual program established in 2000 to indoctrinate young law students who will rise to the top of the legal system and fight for cases involving reproductive rights and sexual justice in accordance with a distinctly Christian worldview. So who's backing them and how are they infiltrating the judicial system?
So the Alliance Defending Freedom, they created this legal fellowship in 2000 called the Blackstone Legal Fellowship. And yeah, it's essentially, it's a 9-week program where they recruit law students. I believe it's first and second year law students. And they bring them, you know, to these trainings where they basically offer, they offer a lot of training in how to integrate the Christian faith into your legal practice. And, you know, the whole purpose of this training is to teach you how to be a lawyer or a judge or, you know, someone in public policy who acts with a Christian intent. And they're very specific on, you know, the mission is essentially to serve God through the legal practice. So they, in addition to these trainings, part of the fellowship is an internship. And the Alliance Defending Freedom through this program, they help connect law students to prestigious internships. And it's, in many cases, they help connect them to legal internships in like clerkships, in state court, in federal court, in state houses, all over the country, essentially. And others go to, you know, public policy think tanks. But that's essentially how it works. And then through these internships and these connections, a lot of these law students, you know, it helps start their career. And many of these the Blackstone Fellowship has a good relationship with many state attorneys general, as we have reported.
And again, I'm speaking with Sophia Resnick, who's an investigative reporter for Rewire.news and has uncovered abuse and exposed religious influence on academic research and public policy in the areas of reproductive health and LGBT discrimination. She was previously an investigative reporter for the American Independent and has written for the Austin Chronicle, and she co-authored the investigative piece at Rewire.news, Not the Illuminati, How Fundamentalist Christians Are Infiltrating State and Federal Government. So how do the Blackstone Fellowship alumni, I mean, is there some kind of confusion between God's laws and man's laws? There are, within the fundamentalist Christian community, people like, for example, Ted Cruz's father, who are dominionists, who believe that Jesus Christ should rule over America as the head of state.
Right. They, you know, in a lot of the literature, they say that when the participants sign up to be part of this fellowship, they have to commit to using their legal careers to, quote, reorder society. That's the phrase that they use, according to a, quote, Christendomic worldview. And they have a very specific idea of their Christianity, which does not necessarily correspond to, you know, Christians all over the country and all over the world, but the Alliance Defending Freedom, they believe that abortion is against God, and that, you know, all forms of non-procreative sex are against God and thus should not be legal. You know, they believe in that homosexuality should not be legal because it's so, yeah, essentially they believe that the laws that that go against God should also, you know, not be, that also go against the state, essentially.
So it's, you throw out the American Constitution and bring in the Old Testament.
Right. It really is a radical idea. And so it's kind of, you know, surprising that they are, perhaps not surprising, but the fact is that they are gaining more and more influence throughout our government. There, you know, currently there are at least two that I'm aware of, former Alliance Defending Freedom leaders currently working for the Trump administration in high offices in the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice and within attorneys general offices throughout the country. And slowly, little by little, in these positions of power and also behind the scenes working on important court cases, this group is trying to bring us closer to, as they, you know, they want to take America back to, I believe, in the piece, the quote was the third, fourth, and fifth centuries.
I mean, they actually
seeks it.
They actually
to recover the robust Christendomic theology of the third, fourth, and fifth centuries.
That is actually their mission statement.
Yes, that is their mission statement for the Blackstone Fellows, that they want. Mm. To recover the robust Christendomic theology of the third, fourth, and fifth centuries.
Good Lord. So how many of these Blackstone individuals have clerked for state and federal judges across the country? Do you know?
So it's been a bit since I've visited the exact numbers. As of 2014, there were approximately 1,400 alumni. And the current number, I'm not aware of what it is at the moment, but there have been a number of as of 2014, there were about 350 fellows who had acted as clerks for state and federal judges.
And they haven't been around that long, so that's pretty successful, pretty influential. And the more you talk about the Blackstone Fellowship and the Alliance Defending Freedom's activities, it does seem quite complementary to the Federalist Society and almost, well, not as successful. I mean, after all, the Federalists have put in, three recent Supreme Court justices, Roberts, Alito, and Gorsuch, and are about to do a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And God help us, maybe a fifth. So It's an amazing situation. And tell us more about how they're eroding the wall between church and state, because that's inherently what's going on here.
Right. And just to one thing you just mentioned, just to add that Justice Alito, actually, when he was an appeals court judge, one of his clerks was a Blackstone fellow named Matt Bauman, who is currently who's currently a lawyer at the Department of Health and Human Services.
And they're the people, by the way, that are allegedly taking care of these children that have been ripped from their parents on the southern border.
Correct. But yes, so with the separation of church and state, the, you know, Alliance Defending Freedom believes that they don't think that there should be a separation. And many of the cases that they take on are cases where students have tried to pray publicly in school or tried to give a public school prayer, or where governments have had sectarian, you know, Christian prayers in the state houses or in local houses and have been sued. You know, they take a lot of these cases and have been successful in some of them because they're trying to, you know, make it to make that line more and more blurry about, you know, what is religion and, you know, where it shouldn't have a purpose in the state government. And they believe the opposite. They think that, you know, they believe in this idea of a Christian nation, and that we are a Christian nation, and we should, you know, live accordingly and be governed accordingly.
So how do you think, or why do you think they've gone under the radar? Because obviously the Federalists have gone under the radar. The idea that they've already gotten through the Chief Justice and Alito and Gorsuch on the court, and they're about to get, you know, one of their list, one of the 20 plus on their list is going to be the next Supreme Court Justice, probably, in spite of the fight that's going to happen. And then if anything happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or she has to retire, mm-hmm. then you'll end up with a 7-2 split, which is just appalling to think about. So what's your sense then of, would you say that they've gone under the radar, this group, the Alliance Defending Freedom and their Blackstone Fellowship, as has the Federalists?
Well, what I think is that they, you know, I think more and more they've gained prominence. And I think, you know, I'm not sure to the extent that the Alliance Defending Freedom is a household name, but they certainly are on TV a lot, especially these days. And they're, you know, very, you know, touting their victories at the Supreme Court. What I think has gone under the radar is the fact that they are so radical, and that they have these very fundamentalist ideas, and that they really do, you know, they really do seem to want to push for a theocratic state, even if they might not say yes to that, to that question. But it's all over their literature. It's all over, you know, all over their tax forms and how they define themselves, and, you know, the funding that they get from other religious right organizations. So I think that's what has gone under the radar, is the fact that that is their end goal and their mission. And when they're on TV defending the crisis pregnancy, you know, why the crisis pregnancy law was, you know, why they argued successfully that it was unconstitutional, they don't talk about it in terms of religion. They talk about it in terms of, you know, this is a free speech case. In the same with, you know, they're also behind these so-called bathroom bills where they make it, you know, illegal for someone who's trans to use a bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity. They say, you know, this isn't about religion. This is about personal freedom for the other students. So it's things like that where I think the religious aspect and the radical aspect have gone under the radar of who they are and what they stand for.
Right. But I think what you're talking about in the case of NIFLA versus Becerra, where the state of California's law was struck down because these pregnancy centers, that these pro-life pregnancy centers were in fact guilty of false advertising. They were crisis centers, but they did not offer any contraceptive or abortion information. They just basically mm-hmm. proselytized and told the woman who was pregnant to go ahead and have the child, and without offering any help in terms of who was going to take care of it. That was where Justice Kagan referred to this as weaponizing the First Amendment, because they did say it was an issue of free speech. But this is what's amazing. These people are practicing censorship, yet they win a court case based upon the freedom of speech. It's amazing, because they censor the information. They're not honest. They're not full disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't you think that's a little ironic? I mean,
yes, and I think there's a lot about that whole law that and the way it was argued that is ironic. But
they're winning. They're winning. They got a heathen and a libertine as a president who is enabling them. It's just, the whole thing is quite surreal. Anyway, Sophia, we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Sophia Resnick, who is an investigative reporter for Rewire.news, who has uncovered abuse and exposed religious influence on academic research and public policy in the areas of reproductive health and LGBT discrimination. She was previously an investigative reporter for the American Independent and has written for the Austin Chronicle, and she co-authored the investigative piece at Rewire.news, Not the Illuminati, How Fundamentalist Christians Are Infiltrating State and Federal Government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into how the Federalists are stacking our courts. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Carl Tobias, a chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond, who writes in a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection. He's the author of over 120 law review articles and the author or co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews, and he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Tobias.
Thank you.
And it seems that this fellow, Leonard Leo, of the Federalist Society, has gone under the radar for quite some time and has had an enormous amount of influence in the selection and confirmation of three Supreme Court justices, John Roberts, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch, and now is playing a key role in choosing a replacement to outgoing Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. So how do you think Leonard Leo flew under the radar for so long?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there have been people in the popular press who have called attention to him. And just as, I guess, yesterday, there was a Wall Street Journal article and a number of others. But he works very quietly, and I think he's very discreet. But I think he networks by way of the Federalist Society, for which he's the executive vice president, and then, of course, has served as President Trump's advisor on federal judicial selection since the administration started, and even before that. He's often credited with compiling the list of 21 Supreme Court possible nominees from whom Trump picked Gorsuch and promised to pick the second Supreme Court justice.
Well, he's also working with Don McGahn, is he not, the White House counsel? And Don McGahn is also a member of the Federalist Society.
Yes, absolutely. And the two of them have worked very closely in the administration thus far. And McGahn, I think, is the formal head of the White House counsel office and has been instrumental, of course, in all of the lower court choices as well as the two Supreme Court nominees.
So what exactly, what's the belief system? How do you become a Federalist? What kind of belief system do you have to have either going in or buying into?
Well, I think it was set up in the early 80s by a number of conservative scholars who felt that law schools, which teach most of the lawyers in the U.S., were too much tilted to the left, if you were, would, in terms of the faculty members and what students learned. And so they were sort of a counter to that. But it grew exponentially in terms of numbers and influence. And what they believe is generally more conservative or libertarian, sometimes in constitutional law considered to be originalists, but it's a very loosely affiliated group. And they call themselves a debating society, but and have thousands of members and chapters all over the country and in most law schools, and put on many programs with very interesting speakers across the spectrum. But I think the average member usually is considered quite conservative politically and as a matter of sort of legal analysis.
But putting three justices on the Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice, and a fourth or possibly a fifth if Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, that is an achievement that's breathtaking, is it not?
Yes, and I think people have asked real questions about whether it's appropriate to outsource, as some people say, though McGahn certainly strongly rejects that, to outsource to a political group the choice of people for the federal bench and especially for the Supreme Court.
And again, I'm speaking with Carl Tobias, who's the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond, who writes in a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection. He's the author of over 120 law review articles and the author or co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews. So there's also, is there a religious component here as well? Because I recall when George W. Bush was choosing Supreme Court justices, he got two bites at the apple, didn't he not? Leonard Leo was sharing the stage at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast. Is he also a conservative Catholic? I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary thing to have a Supreme Court where I think all but two of the nine justices are Catholics.
Well, there are a large number. I think Neil Gorsuch is considered to be a Protestant.
Right, Episcopalian, right.
Right, but then there are some Jewish justices, mm-hmm. Breyer, Kagan, mm-hmm. and Ginsburg. But it is unusual, but that's one of the virtues of diversity in the United States. I think that I'm not entirely positive, but I think he is Catholic, and I think practicing Catholic. And it's not surprising that the Federal Society would have conservative views on religion because the members generally have conservative views. And so they would be concerned about First Amendment, freedom of religion, and Establishment Clause kinds of issues. And I think take fairly conservative positions on those issues, which are often at the Supreme Court.
Well, I bring it up because there's apparently a great deal of buzz about the possibility that Judge Amy Coney Barrett will be the nominee to replace Justice Kennedy. She's a professor at, she was a professor at Notre Dame, where she led a group of academics who were opposed to abortion. And she was, I don't think she'd barely been a judge. I think she wasn't a judge before Trump appointed her recently to the appeals court. And now she's likely to be appointed to or nominated to the Supreme Court. Isn't the point about the Federalists that just by definition they're against Roe v. Wade?
Well, I think a number of the members may be opposed to it, that opinion. But whether a number of them would agree that it should be overruled is less clear. And there's a big issue about precedent and how the Supreme Court ought to be cautious before it overturns longstanding precedents. So I think there's some debate there. And Judge Barrett has been a member of the Seventh Circuit since November of last year.
But prior to that, she wasn't a judge.
That's right. She was a faculty member at Notre Dame, her alma mater.
Isn't that unusual?
To become a federal judge when you have been a law professor before that?
Well, never judged a trial, never been in a practicing judge. I mean, I would have thought that that would be a prerequisite.
Not necessarily. I mean, she was preceded on that court by two others, Richard Posner and Frank Easterbrook, both of whom taught at Chicago, and I think neither of them engaged in very much practice, or was it, and certainly neither was a judge before that. So she has some pretty good role models there. But a number of federal appellate judges have been judges either in the state or federal system before being elevated to the appellate bench.
So just to sort of focus in on the process that's coming up on Monday, of course, we'll hear from the president who his choice is. And as I say, my sense is it's probably going to be Amy Barrett. But how will the questioning go? Because as you just pointed out, that there's some wiggle room between, I mean, first of all, if asked point blank about Roe v. Wade, they won't answer that question, will they? But then you could ask them the next question, which would be, what is your position on settled law, which is what Senator Susan Collins is warning about. And, of course, I recall that during the confirmation for John Roberts, he made a big deal out of stare decisis, that he believed in precedent and not overturning them. And he said he'd just be the umpire and call balls and strikes. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. Citizens United was that really broke precedent. It's had an enormous impact on our politics. So what do you expect in terms of the maneuvering that goes on there, where, to my mind, really relevant questions never get answered and boilerplate questions do get answered?
Well, I think it's an interesting point that you raise, and many people have been critical, especially of the Supreme Court confirmation process. But I think you're correct that a direct question about a particular precedent is not likely to be answered when the nominee, if confirmed, would address a related issue once on the bench. And I think that's usually the line that most nominees follow. But I do think it's a legitimate question to ask about precedent, and I think that's extremely likely, and that could yield some sense of how the justice-to-be might resolve those kinds of questions.
But how do you feel about what happened with John Roberts? Am I correct in suggesting that he made a big deal out of stare decisis, and then once he was on the bench, he didn't necessarily follow through on that pledge?
Well, I think that's true of many justices, and certainly there have been a number of precedents that have been overturned, you know, throughout Supreme Court history. But the longer and more well-established a precedent is, the more justices are reluctant to overturn it without very strong reasons.
So do you think, well, let me ask you, since I've suggested that Amy Barrett is likely to be the choice, and you know, I don't have any special inside information. It just seems that as a political choice, that would be the sort of cleverest, to having a woman to be the deciding one to get rid of Roe v. Wade. But there are others on there that seem very qualified, like Gorsuch was. So it'd be hard for the Democrats to make a case against them. Although one of the front runners, of course, work for Ken Starr, and I imagine a lot of Democrats feel pretty bruised about that whole Whitewater thing that went on forever and finally yielded Monica Lewinsky's dress. So what's your sense? And there's also Judge Pryor. He would be pretty inflammatory, wouldn't he, to the Democrats?
Well, I think that's right. He's extremely conservative, but I don't have the sense that he's at the top of the list and hasn't been interviewed. You're correct, Judge Kavanaugh and then Judge Kethledge of the Sixth Circuit from Michigan seem to be at the top of the list, and both of them have had decade-long careers on the federal appellate bench. And so we'll see, but they seem the likely competition, with perhaps Amy Barrett as a third choice for the president.
Well, there's also Amul Thapar, right?
Thapar, right.
Of the
yes.
Sixth Circuit. And he has a sort of interesting life story, does he not?
Yes. and he would bring significant diversity to the bench. He's also strongly supported by the majority leader, Mitch McConnell.
And he's from Kentucky, is he not?
Yes, and he has the advantage. He's been a federal district judge for about a decade before his service as the first confirmee of President Trump on the Sixth Circuit.
So, again, it's hard not to sort of analyze this in terms of the politics of the moment as opposed to whether this selection process is about getting the right person or the best person for the job. Was that ever a consideration? I don't mean to be cynical.
No, well, I think all presidents would like to think they're going to choose the perfect Supreme Court justice, and I think most do their best to come to that point, but many times there are politics of the moment that can overwhelm or at least substantially affect the process.
So what's your hunch then? It's going to be announced on Monday.
Well, my best sense now is that Kavanaugh probably has the inside track, but he has many detractors and also would be seen as a D.C. insider, for what that's worth. And Trump did promise to drain the swamp. So that is what some people have said. Kethledge would be more the outsider, someone from the Midwest, Michigan, and then Judge Barrett, and perhaps Thapar, who also would be from Kentucky. So it's hard to know, but I think all four of them are in the mix for sure and near the top.
And if Kavanaugh were the nominee, I am assuming that the Democrats will want to talk about Ken Starr's investigation, because I think it serves as a kind of contrast, does it not, to what the Republicans are now complaining about, the Mueller investigation, which, relatively speaking, has hardly taken any time compared to how the Whitewater Lewinsky thing eventually took, I can't remember how many years. So will that be an opportunity, do you think, for some old grudges to be aired?
It may be. Though he's unlikely to say very much about it, and he has at least 10 years of writing opinions on the D.C. Circuit, which is the second most important court, and some of those opinions obviously are critically important and somewhat controversial as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Kyle Tobias. I realize we're looking at the tea leaves here, which is kind of somewhat futile, but interesting.
Yes, absolutely. It's a fascinating part of our American democracy.
And again, I've been speaking with Kyle Tobias, who's the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond, who writes on a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection. He's the author of over 120 law review articles and the author or co-author of more than 80 essays, commentaries, and other shorter works in law reviews. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lerivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.